Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. At the controls, Jason Croft. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. In this part of Focus 580, we will be exploring some of the history of the cigarette in America. And I think that you could say, certainly I would say now, having taken a look at the book we'll be talking about here this morning, that few, if any, products have been as heavily promoted in this country or have become as deeply entrenched in the American consciousness as the cigarette. And our guest for this hour, Alan Brandt, who's a medical historian, I think he would say that that is not an accident. The tobacco industry pioneered in the development of public relations and special interest lobbying and corporate spin, all of that aimed at getting people to smoke, and also to cast doubt on the potential harms of smoking. This and much more can be found in his newly published book titled The Cigarette Century, and the subtitle is The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. The book has just come out recently. It's published by Basic Books. Our guest, Alan Brandt, is professor in the history of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is also professor in the Department of the History of Science at Harvard, and he is talking with us this morning from there. We're pleased to have one of those high-quality audio connections that we like so much. So it sounds like he's here with us, but in fact, he is in Harvard, joining us by ISDN. We also want to thank Evan Whitney, who's the engineer there at the other end. As we talk this morning with Alan Brandt, questions are welcome from people who are listening, and all you need to do to be a part of the conversation is pick up the telephone and dial the number, like always, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 at any point. Questions from listeners are certainly welcome. Professor Brandt, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very good.
Thanks for talking with us. It certainly is the case that I can't imagine any other single product that you could talk about that would give you the opportunity to get into as many different subjects as the cigarette. And I suppose I hadn't really thought about it very much before looking at the cigarette century. But it gives you an opportunity to talk about cultural mores, about people's behavior, about gender issues, about advertising and public relations, about politics and economics, about health and research into health. And one of the things I think that makes the book so very interesting is that it gets into all of that. It touches on all of those areas. And as I said, and I think you make the point that there's probably nothing else that you could, no single thing you could talk about that has, that stretches into that many different areas.
Well, I think it is just a remarkable story. And this is what really drew me to cigarettes and cigarette smoking. It's obviously been a very contentious issue in our society for at least the last 50 years. But you really can't take anything from technology to business to politics and regulation to our rising concern about special interests and the impact that they have on our policies without finding how it's configured in the cigarette. And so that was really my strategy. Use the cigarette to understand the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's just plunge in. I guess part of the cigarette history here that I think is interesting is if you consider the fact that people use tobacco for a very long time, but that the cigarette as we know it, as a mass-produced factory-made item, is a bit more recent. Say that only dates until maybe the 1880s, I suppose. And before that, people smoked cigarettes, but either they rolled them or they actually were rolled by in factories. They were actually rolled. People actually made cigarettes by hand. And the big thing was when somebody invented the machine that would make the cigarette.
That's right. Yeah. And obviously tobacco was a critical part of the colonial economy in the early United States. But one of the things I emphasize in the book is just how modern the cigarette really is, the mass-produced, technologically rolled cigarette. It's really just about 120, 125 years old. So it really transformed many aspects of American culture. But it's relatively new. we always talk about tobacco and the importance and the discovery of the Americas and the fact that Native Americans were using indigenous tobacco crops before the Europeans arrived. But really, this is about the transformation of our industrial and consumer economy at the turn of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. That it's interesting that while people and you have here in at one point in the book a graph that shows the forms of tobacco that people used, and if you looked at what was going on in 1900, it looks like most people were actually chewing it, and then also there were other forms, but the big change between 1900 and just 1952, so that's only 52 years, is the enormous increase in the percentage of tobacco use that goes to cigarettes, and those other forms become much, much smaller. It's mostly cigarettes. So, but the thing is that once the industry came to the point where they could make cigarettes, then they had to get people to smoke cigarettes. It's not like they had to persuade them to use tobacco, but here was a new thing a way of using it that people hadn't been doing before. How did they go about trying to create a market for the cigarette?
Well, once you have this problem of overproduction and overcapacity, it really raises very centrally, how are we going to sell them? How are we going to create a market? And the tobacco industry really innovated in all of the aspects that today we associate with our consumer society. So advertising, public relations, making sure that cigarettes were in film and in the media. All of these were critical aspects, and the industry was brilliant in the deployment of new strategies around advertising and marketing.
It's again, what's an interesting and fascinating part of this history is if you take a look at, say, the early 20th century in the United States, there was actually a strong anti-cigarette mood. In some states, cigarettes were actually illegal, not just for minors. That was perhaps a bit more common, but there were some places where nobody could get a cigarette. It was illegal for anybody to have a cigarette. And that it seems remarkable that in a relatively short period of time, we go from that point to the point where we were, say, in the 50s, where cigarette smoking was very, very common.
Well, it's really one of the most remarkable stories, because if you start out in 1900, cigarette smoking is very marginalized and highly stigmatized. The idea that delinquent boys sneak off behind the school and share cigarettes, and how to stop America from becoming a smoking society. It was considered immoral. It was associated with the claims against alcohol and other sins. And the industry had to be very strategic about how to normalize cigarette use during this early part of the 20th century and make it popular and part of the culture. About the worst thing you could say about somebody in 1870 was that they were indulgent and pleasure-seeking. And by the 1920s, we see ads that say, indulge in a Lucky Strike, the most pleasurable cigarette. Mm. And I think there's a real change in the culture that's marked by the cigarette about leisure, about pleasure, really within the larger cultural economy.
Just quickly, let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in, Alan Brandt. He's professor of the history of medicine at Harvard Med School. He's also professor in the Department of the History of Science at Harvard University, and he's author of a new book that looks at the cigarette in America. It's titled The Cigarette Century, and it's published by Basic Books. It's out now. It's just officially been out, about a month, a little bit less than a month, actually. And so I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that the tobacco industry did to promote smoking and to try to persuade people that that cigarettes were okay is that they heavily promoted smoking among the soldiers fighting in World War I.
That's right. And many boys went over to fight in France and came back absolutely committed, and now we understand better, addicted smokers. And I think it's a transformative moment. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, for example, was one of the major opponents of cigarette smoking through the last years of the 19th and first years of the 20th century. But when they get over to France and they set up these camp support programs, they actually begin to hand out cigarettes for free. And General Pershing, who runs the American Expeditionary Forces in France, says tobacco is as important as bullets for the welfare and morale of our troops. So literally thousands and thousands of men went off to France, came back smoking, and that was really a critical moment in the transformation of making America a smoking society.
Yeah. Also, at that time, here we see smoking cigarettes becoming more accepted. But at least at that point, there was still a strong stigma associated with women and smoking. That is, it was still thought to be a thing that this was just not, well, okay, if men, that's okay for men to smoke, but women smoking was just not on. And here we see an interesting example of how we see the involvement of the early public relations industry the way that smoking for women got linked with the idea of women's, I don't know if they would have used the term women's liberation at the time, women's rights, women's suffrage, you know, being modern and somehow for women got associated with public smoking.
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, in 1928, and it was this weekend, the Easter parade weekend, a public relations official for American Tobacco, one of the great fathers of American public relations, Edward Bernays, decides that he'll set up a news item by having women smoke in public on the street. And this was considered taboo before that time, and he arranged to have news photographers there. And he said they will go out on the street in the parade and light up what he called their torches of freedom. And this became very powerfully associated with women getting the vote, women's equality, and the idea that if men could smoke, so too should women. And so some of the inhibitions that the industry had to deal with about advertising directly to women begin to dissipate at that time. And it becomes very powerfully associated with the idea that if you're a modern woman, you smoke. And there's big debate in many colleges about women smoking. And by the 1930s, women are smoking with men in all social settings.
Mm. One of the landmark points where a lot of people started to think differently about smoking would have been the Surgeon General's report of 1964, right?
Yes.
Yeah, 1964. Talking where it said in a very unequivocal way that there was this link between lung cancer and smoking. At what point could you say that it was scientific research had firmly, if not incontrovertibly, established that there was a causal link between smoking cigarettes and lung cancer?
Well, there was always a lot of health concern about smoking going all the way back into the 19th century. But it was difficult to demonstrate clearly and causally that smoking led to the problems that physicians would see in their patients. So in the 1930s, a number of chest surgeons and lung specialists begin to observe that among their patients who are having serious symptoms, up to and including lung cancer, there's a very high relationship of patients who smoke. One of the most famous is a New Orleans surgeon, Alton Oxner. And he says, I've never had a patient with lung cancer who did not smoke. And that's around 1939, 1940. But getting to the actual causal link required really looking at populations and population health. What I think I would say to your question is that by the early 1950s, there had been very substantial epidemiological investigations into this relationship where researchers began to compare groups of smokers to groups of non-smokers. And what they found is, first, the groups of smokers died earlier, And then the second thing they found is that lung cancer was very, very highly associated, causally associated with cigarette smoking. So I would say by 1950, certainly by 1954, there was categorical evidence that cigarette smoking was seriously harmful to health and a cause of serious diseases.
Certainly you can see, if nothing else, there is statistical evidence that would suggest to you that there was something going on. And for example, at one point here in the book, you present a graph where you chart out for men and women incidence of various kinds of cancer. And here, for example, we see in men between 1930 and looks like, I don't know if it's 2000, or at least between 1930 and 1990, there is a very precipitous increase in lung cancer, particularly from between 1950 and 1990. It just shoots way up, where you'd have to look at that and you would have to immediately, the question you would ask is, well, why is that? Particularly when you look at other forms of cancer that are relatively flat. And it would seem that you would look at that and you would look at all kinds of things. And if you saw over that same period of time, significant increases in the numbers of people who smoke, you would have to say it's not unreasonable to think there was some sort of relationship between those two things. It seems like that made an impression on some people, but the issue is that it was not enough simply to say, well, there's a statistical thing here that we can point to. You can point to it on a graph. Doesn't that suggest to you that there's something going on, that there's some connection between that and cigarettes?
Well, here's the thing. Diseases like lung cancer often lag some 20, sometimes 20 years, sometimes even longer after the introduction of the cigarette. So at first, there weren't enough cases of lung cancer to easily demonstrate the linkage. And then there were alternative hypotheses as physicians and scientists began to look at this obvious rise in cases of lung cancer. Some people said it's the automobile. Other people said perhaps it's paving roads because asphalt roads give off a number of toxins. And so there were alternative hypotheses. But by the late 1940s, 1950s, a group of scientists and physicians are beginning to really explicitly hone in on the cigarette. And the other thing that became known quite quickly was that there were a number of carcinogens in burning tobacco smoke. So the combination of the character of the hypothesis, the statistical evidence, and other laboratory-based evidence about the carcinogens really led to very serious conclusions by the middle of the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the other point that has to be made is that all along here, the tobacco industry mounted a very deliberate effort to cast doubt on the idea that there was some connection between adverse health effects and smoking cigarettes.
Well, that's right. And one of the most striking things that we now know is that the industry had all the evidence that was known publicly by physicians and scientists in the 50s in their own laboratories. And they knew a great deal about the carcinogens in tobacco. Yet at the same time, they explicitly denied that smoking was harmful. They introduced filters with the implication that they had successfully discovered how to filter out the harmful elements. And they began a campaign, a major campaign of scientific disinformation to confuse the public about the known harms of their product.
To me, I think one of the remarkable things is if you go back and look at some of the older advertising for cigarettes is the presence of physicians, what purport to be physicians, doctors saying, for example, here's one here from the early 1930s. It's an illustration. Here we have a man who is wearing a white coat, so clearly he's supposed to be a doctor, and he has pince-nez glasses on. He looks a little bit like Franklin Roosevelt. and he's holding up a package of Lucky Strikes, and the copy says, 20,679 physicians say Luckies are less irritating. It's sort of sad in a way, and yet it's kind of funny that there was this deliberate effort on the part of the industry to put images of doctors in advertising as if to say, I smoke these, and if it's okay for me, it's okay for you.
Well, the industry was eager to reassure the American public, and one of their principal strategies for doing this was to suggest that, of course, doctors smoke, and many did through the course of the middle of the 20th century, and that if doctors were smoking, this would reassure the public. So they had very aggressive campaigns targeted to doctors with the idea that if somebody came to a physician and said, doctor, I'm a little worried about my cigarettes and I've developed a cough and I've been having some chest pain, that the doctor might say, well, why don't you switch to my brand? And this was a classic strategy of advertising, especially through the 30s and the 40s right into the 1950s.
We are already at our midpoint. We have a caller here we'll get to, and other people who are listening certainly are welcome to call in with questions. Our guest is Alan Brandt. He is professor of the history of medicine at Harvard Med School, also professor in the Department of the History of Science at Harvard, and is the author of the recently published book, The Cigarette Century. The subtitle is The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. It's published by Basic Books. And certainly questions are welcome. Again, people who are listening can help us by being brief in their comments. We just ask that to keep things going along. But, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Someone here in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'll make this very quick. I really appreciate the program that you have because I've worked with patients who have, I'm a nurse, who have cancer of the lung, and I know how hard it is to not be able to breathe. My husband is a physician from Harvard also. Anyhow, I just want to say no smoking. I think, is there any redeeming quality of smoking? Anyhow, I'm eager to read your book. I'll hang up.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. I'm sure that you would want to second the caller's urging people not to smoke. I'm just curious now, today, do we have some numbers on how many people smoke here in the United States and how that has changed over the past 20, 30 years?
Yeah, it's really a great story of public health because so many Americans have quit smoking. And at the time of the first Surgeon General's report that you referred to, 1964, almost half of all American adults were regular smokers. And we've cut that number down to about 20%. One in five Americans today is a regular smoker. And we don't see smokers as much anymore because smoking is banned in many public places and you can't smoke in many restaurants and bars in many towns and cities around the United States. I think it's not clear that we still have a very serious problem here with smoking. About 50 million Americans are still smokers. It leads to over 430,000 deaths in the United States each year, and that's more than HIV, auto accidents, suicides and homicides, illicit drugs, and alcohol combined. So we still have an enormous problem about smoking here, but one of the things we've learned is that we can do a lot about it through education, through good public policies, and by letting people know just how harmful this is. We can still make additional progress.
Mm-hmm. Certainly at the time that the Surgeon General's report was issued, there were still a lot of people smoking, and I'm certain that the industry was very powerful. Was the decision to issue that report in Washington, was that controversial, and were there people who tried to prevent the Surgeon General from making that announcement?
Well, the industry very much did not want there to be an independent investigation and report on smoking because they very much knew how it would turn out. as a result of their own research and the fact that they knew that independent experts by 1964 had really lined up, convinced of the harms of smoking. But they did everything they could to undercut the report, to raise questions about it. And then they did everything they could following the report to subvert any very serious regulations that one might have anticipated after the Surgeon General has told the American public that cigarette smoking causes cancer.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned in the book here is that there were a lot of people who thought that once that report was released, then a lot of Americans would quit smoking. But it really didn't happen. It didn't. Maybe there was a little bit of an initial dip in smoking, but overall, it didn't have much of an effect.
Well, that's right. And I think in 1964, most observers pretty much underestimated a couple of things. One was the intense addictiveness of nicotine. So even when smokers heard the Surgeon General's warnings and they tried to quit, they soon found it was very difficult. The other thing they didn't really anticipate was how effective the industry would be both at undercutting any regulation and continuing to aggressively promote their products by offering filters, low tar, light cigarettes, all euphemisms to suggest that the problems with the product had been successfully addressed, even though within the industry it was absolutely clear that they did not have the technical capacity to make a safe product.
And just one further point, and I promise I've got callers here I'll get to, that I think one of the things we understand now about cigarettes, and certainly if someone has been a smoker and have tried to quit, you know that it's very difficult. The reason that it is difficult, one of the reasons is that cigarettes have nicotine in them, and nicotine is addictive. At what point can we say that the tobacco industry, first of all, knew that? They knew that that was an important chemical and that it was in there in the cigarettes and that was what it was that got people to continue to smoke, but that they really understood that to the point where they actually manipulated nicotine levels in cigarettes to make certain that once people started smoking, they would continue to smoke.
Well, they knew for a very long time that nicotine was addictive, and it was crucial to the success of their product. After it became clear that cigarette smoking caused lung cancer, the industry obviously had some interest in trying to reduce the carcinogens and the tars that result in cancer and other very serious diseases, especially heart disease, stroke, emphysema. So they began to experiment taking tars out of their cigarettes. What they found is when you take out tars, you also take out nicotine. And what they found is when they went to very low tar cigarettes, they didn't have adequate nicotine to sustain the addiction that was crucial to the success of their product. So they started to put nicotine back in. And so now we know a good deal about just how sophisticated the industry was in the technical and engineering aspects of their product and how central nicotine has been to them in order to maintain a market, especially as education and social convention changed about the nature of the product. And we know that many Americans who are smoking today, especially this last group of smokers, in a sense the 1 in 5, many of them are highly addicted, many have tried to quit. And we're really talking about a population that we know a lot about now and is highly addicted to nicotine.
We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them, starting with line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, we have an issue that's percolating in the Champaign-Urbana area concerning a ban on cigarette smoking in bars and restaurants, which is in effect, I believe, as of January 1 of this year. And there are people within the community who are opposed to this, especially the bar owners, who say their revenues have dropped precipitously once this ban has come into play. We have a city council contest in Champaign where at least one or two or maybe more of the contestants are explicitly or implicitly saying they will repeal the smoking ban And on the scientific side, those who are opposed to it, in addition to saying their right to smoke is a fundamental constitutional right, are saying they have no belief in the danger of secondhand smoke, notwithstanding what I believe the Surgeon General recently said, that secondhand smoke is just as harmful as direct smoke. Am I right in terms of the danger of secondhand smoke to non-smokers who just happen to be exposed to the smoke of others?
Well, there's no question that now there's absolutely clear scientific evidence that secondhand smoke is dangerous to non-smokers. Fortunately, most of us are not exposed to as much secondhand smoke as smokers expose themselves to. So there may well be differences in the amount of exposure and the incidence of disease that results from secondhand smoke. But there's really no question secondhand smoke, like direct smoke for smokers, is highly toxic and dangerous to those who are around. And I think there is a difference in that Americans are sensitive about risks that are imposed on them by others. And so most smoking bans in restaurants and bars in most public places have actually been quite popular. And most of the economic evidence for restaurant and bar owners and other businesses is that actually their businesses have improved in the face of these kinds of public smoking restrictions. So I think the evidence is clear. And from a policy perspective, there's no question that these smoking bans have been a major contributor to better public health.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that it is certainly true that more and more places across the country we have seen local ordinances passed that ban smoking in public places, and that there have been complaints from people who run bars and restaurants saying that they think that that's going to heavily impact their businesses. Bars particularly, the owners say, if my patrons can't smoke, they're not going to come here. Has there been very much work done on the economic impact on a community of banning smoking in public?
There has been quite a bit of very good work. And my understanding in places like Boston, where you can no longer smoke in bars, San Francisco, the major smoking bans that went into effect in New York City, the remarkable story of the banning of smoking in Irish pubs, which people thought there would be a great deal of opposition to and would be very costly to pub owners. In all of these instances, these businesses have not only survived well, but did better in the face of smoking bans. And if you go into the tobacco documents, and now we have a lot of access to internal tobacco documents, we know that the tobacco industry has done everything possible to bring together restaurateurs and other business owners in opposition to these bans. So when you see opposition, one can often know that the tobacco industry is not far behind.
All right. The next caller we have is also here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. This is line two. Hello.
Yes. Comment on the news that the so-called real cost is about $37, $38 a pack. And as just mentioned, what were the states that very early tried to make cigarettes illegal for everyone? And how did they do it, and when did they stop?
Well, they did it in the years either during or right after the First World War. A lot of these measures were tied to bans on alcohol. And so I think they were widely perceived as essentially not oriented towards health so much as public morals. And some of the bans in some states were directly for women or children. And so I think that in the face of the normalcy of the 1920s, most of these bans were withdrawn. I'm not sure they were a really effective experiment in approaches to regulating tobacco. But it does harken back to a time where the cultural authority of the cigarette was in a very different place.
All right, and to a cell phone caller here, line three. Hello.
Hi. I remember reading some while back that there was a lot of statistical evidence from the German Army during World War II that they had done a lot of studies, and they kept very detailed records, and this information was either suppressed or denied because it came out of, you know, the German Army. I was wondering if you had any information about that.
I do have some, and I have a colleague, Robert Proctor, at Stanford University, who's done extensive work on German anti-tobacco campaigns, and I would refer you to his work. But one of the things Proctor and others have found is that within Nazi Germany, there was a great deal of hostility to the cigarette, often on health grounds, and there was early epidemiological research done under the Third Reich that indicated, similarly to work that would occur later, that smoking caused lung cancer and other diseases. But as you can imagine, in the period of the war and the post-war period, there were many reasons why physicians and scientists did not want to rely on Nazi science. And so the work was done in some instances, again, I would argue in some instances, much better by British and American epidemiologists, principally in the late 1940s and early 1950s.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. To another caller, this is Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. On your book tour, are you hearing or do you already know about this? The Sharon Eubanks was with the DOJ and this RICO suit against the tobacco industry. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I've been following that story closely because I actually worked with Sharon Eubanks and her tobacco litigation team at the Department of Justice as an expert witness. And I testified in that trial, so I know Eubanks well. I know her colleagues.
She is speaking out now, and she's saying that she sees it as a part of the whole political manipulation of the DOJ. The specifics, I don't know if you want to lay them out, but what I understand is that she was going to win, and the politicals came out and sort of undermined her case, made her change her case analysis, all sorts of bizarre things. I'm glad you've heard about it. I think it should be sort of front and center on the political influence and the tobacco industry, because it was $120 billion that was going to go towards smoking cessation. The Bush administration, by their own politicals, cut it back to $10 billion or something like that and backed off of the legal analysis of the case. If that's a fair assessment, I don't know what more you could add, I would appreciate you taking the story around as your book chatting, because I think it's a really how much $120 billion would have done to helping people stop there's a lot of lung cancer and death. I'm getting apoplectic here about it. I'm so angry.
Right.
But,
well, I agree with you. I think it's a very important story. The DOJ had an expert witness, Dr. Michael Fiore, who's a smoking cessation expert from the University of Wisconsin. And he was an expert testifying in the remedies phase of the trial. And Fiore had designed a national cessation program. And one of the stipulations that the appeals court had put on the RICO statute was that any remedies had to be forward-looking. So Eubanks and her team were looking for so-called forward-looking remedies that would effectively take on the problems that arose from the racketeering and fraud that the industry committed. And Fiore estimated that a national cessation program would cost about $130 billion a year. And this was what her team intended to ask the judge for at the end of the trial. But at that point, and my understanding is that there was political interventions within the DOJ and also connected to the White House that required her and her team to ask for only about $10 billion. There's one other thing I should point out about the Department of Justice's civil prosecution of the companies under the fraud and racketeering statutes is that the judge in the case, federal circuit court judge, Gladys Kessler, found that, in fact, the companies had violated the racketeering statutes over a 50-year period. And her opinion in the case is really a remarkable indictment of industry behavior that has continued up until today and, according to her opinion, continues even now. She ordered the companies in her decision to cease and desist using the terms light and low tar because they're so misleading to consumers. She went on to order that they stop using that not just here in the United States, but in their promotion of tobacco around the world. And the companies immediately appealed that and had a stay placed on her order. But the companies have been found to have violated the statutes that our Congress passed in order to control organized crime. And I think that really speaks volumes.
Again, we go to another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
I find it interesting to read the letters to the editor from people who describe themselves as smokers. They're not people who smoke. They're smokers. And about how people promoting the ban are abridging the rights of smokers. But what we're really coming and the folks who would like to have better air in restaurants and bars are described as bullies. But what we're really talking about is a bunch of people who are addicts who cannot go for 3 or 4 hours without having a cigarette. And they're telling the rest of us that they can't manage this. And it's really rather pitiful, I think. And I think if we turn the language around and describe it in these terms to ourselves and to the folks who want to reverse the ban here in Champaign-Urbana and elsewhere, that it puts it in a more realistic light, to my mind. I've also posed this question to other guests on this radio show about the costs of smoking to the health system. And what I usually hear back is that it actually is cheaper to let people get sick and die because you don't have to pay as much Social Security. But it seems to me that there are additional costs in terms of things like where we have our doctors focusing their training and their time and where we have emergency rooms dealing with, in addition to things like diabetes complications and other things, but heart attacks and strokes that we would not have as many of. And also the disability levels of that occur because of smoking, and not only lung related, but it seems whenever I turn around, there's some new thing that I'm reading about how cigarette smoking affects all kinds of organs in our bodies, our the discs in our back. I saw somewhere that was related to cervical cancer. All kinds of things. So do you have any response to either of those two things?
Well, I have a couple of responses. The first thing, as you point out, is that cigarette smoking not only causes lung cancer, which of course we know that it does, it causes pulmonary diseases of all sorts and many other problems. So that's really, you know, part of our science and knowledge now. It has to be part of these discussions. And secondhand smoke similarly has tremendous health effects and is particularly dangerous to kids who have asthma, other people have respiratory infections or respiratory problems. And so there's just no question about the health issues. The costs are tremendous. And there's just no question that if we could control smoking, we would control one of the most dangerous disease-producing behaviors in our culture, even now when we're down to 1 in 5. And so I agree with you. I'm not that sympathetic about reversing bans. I think people who want to smoke now are going to have to find places where they can continue to. But what we really need more than anything else are better strategies to keep kids from beginning to be smokers, most smokers begin as children and adolescents. And then we also need better treatments and better strategies for helping people who want to quit. And if we really directed attention at those two issues, prevention and cessation, we could really begin to bring down the numbers of smokers, not just in American society, but around the world where smoking is really becoming a pandemic.
That gets it just quickly, a question that I wanted to raise, because the tobacco industry worldwide is a big industry, and it is a worldwide industry, and certainly American companies do sell internationally. What would be the impact, I wonder, on them, and perhaps also on, if you can say, on the American economy, if, just for the sake of argument, all the people in the United States now who smoke just stopped?
Well, it would be gigantic, because smoking, even in the United States, where we now only have 20% smokers, or just a little bit more than that, remains tremendously lucrative for Philip Morris, Altria, R.J. Reynolds, and the other major producers. So there really are powerful economic and social issues about how to go from being smoking societies to no smoking societies. And we'll need to think much more critically about industry, income, public revenues in order to truly make societies no smoking. And I think that's one of the areas that we haven't explored adequately yet, is how to change agricultural economies, how to change a range of business economies. And we underestimate the power of these businesses and industries to shape the regulatory environment.
And as far as individuals are concerned, if what you're trying to do is move to a non-smoking society, in addition to restricting where you can smoke and perhaps imposing taxes on the product and making it expensive, and then the educational campaign that's aimed at persuading people that it's bad for you, is there anything in addition to those three things that would seem to be good tools, if that was what your goal was, to persuade people not to smoke, or if they did, to get them to stop?
Well, I think all those are important and have been shown under the right conditions with the right resources to be effective. We could do a lot more in terms of restricting advertising. The industry has always been incredibly inventive in how to use their logos, how to get kids interested in tobacco products from a very early age. And so we need to look at the packaging. We need to look at advertising. We need to look at taxes. We need to look at tobacco smuggling, which is one of the ways that tobacco producers have avoided the taxes and kept the prices of cigarettes lower in many countries. And we really need to do this as a global collaborator on the problem of tobacco, as opposed to every nation state doing it on its own. There is some promising activity in this area, because the World Health Organization recently put out a treaty, the Framework Convention for Tobacco Control, which is the first treaty ever put forward by the World Health Organization. And it really lays out many of these areas, from taxation to advertising to restrictions on public smoking, that would encourage countries to really be part of an international effort to reduce tobacco use. It obviously also is greatly configured in trade, and globalization, the opening up of new markets, has really created opportunities for the industry, which they're seizing. And so from a public health perspective, we really need to think about the relationship of trade and health.
I want to see if we can get at least one more caller. Rantoul is next, line one.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I just want to make a couple comments. What do you think of the movie starring Russell Crowe called The Insider? Are you familiar with that movie?
I am, and I think it's quite an interesting movie, because it captures really two things. One is the importance that whistleblowers have played in getting the tobacco story out. And I have to say, as a historian who has used thousands of internal secret tobacco company memoranda and letters, I'm struck by the idea that these materials might not have been available to me to write about, but to even much more importantly to the public. And they have reshaped the regulatory and public health environment about tobacco. They're widely available on the web now. I invite your listeners to just get a look at how explicit the industry was about getting around regulation, deceiving the American public about the harms of their product. It's really a dreadful story. But it's a story we know. And the movie that you mentioned portrays one of the brave scientists who came forward to explain what was going on inside the companies. The other side of that was, would the American media, in this case CBS and 60 Minutes, help get the story out? And the tobacco industry helped set up roadblocks, threats of suits, and at least for a time managed to squash the story. And so part of the history of this is the idea of how important public knowledge is to really understand first the harms of the product, but also what we can do about it.
Yeah, you know, a couple of years ago, I actually got a chance to meet Jeffrey Wigand, the guy who the movie was about. He was here on this program. He was visiting the campus. And one of the things that I asked him was, I said, well, I had just in preparing for the interview with him, I had sat down to watch the movie. And I said to him, is that pretty much the way it was? And he said to me, yeah, that's pretty much the way it was. He seemed to feel that was a fairly, obviously it was a movie, and it was, I'm sure that they did certain things to make it more dramatic. But as far as his experience, he said, yes, basically that was what it was like.
It's an amazing story. It was a devastating time for the national news services, especially ABC and CBS. ABC was sued by Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds and ended up capitulating on a libel suit based upon what was a day one show. It was a show like 60 Minutes because of claims they made about nicotine manipulation. And then later that year, when a producer at CBS, Lowell Bergman, got the Wigand story, CBS refused to let him run it because they might have legal liabilities. And these are really amazing stories about big industry in the media getting out a story that's of special significance yeah. for public well-being.
We're going to have to stop. There is much, much more in the book that we've talked about. You might want to check it out. It's The Cigarette Century, published by Basic Books, by our guest Alan Brandt. He's professor of the history of medicine at Harvard Med School and professor in the Department of the History of Science at Harvard University. Professor Brandt, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Also want to say thanks to the engineer there on the other end at Harvard, Evan Whitney.